David Foster Wallace was an American novelist that came on the scene in the 1980s, and with every new novel or book of short stories he would write, his fame enlarged commensurately, such that not long ago, Time magazine noted him as one of the top 100 authors in the last 100 years. 4 years ago, at the age of 46, he took his own life after having suffered profound bouts of depression. And 4 years before that happened, he actually wrote a short story that I read this week called Good Old Neon, which is ironically about a person contemplating that very act. And he realizes in that short story that he is mostly a fraud, that everything he does is meant to create a perception in those he encounters. And as that recognition overtakes him, he realizes he needs a therapist. And so he goes to one. And his recognition of exerting every fiber of his being to create that perception leads him to ask this therapist, "What's going on in me?" And in the short story, he summarizes the worldview of this therapist and helps him to explain his own world. And that, he says, "It turned out that one of Dr. Gustafson's basic operating premises was the claim that there were really only two basic fundamental orientations a person could have toward the world, love and fear, and they couldn't coexist. Each day of your life was spent in service to one of these masters or the other, and that one of the worst things about the conception of competitive, achievement-oriented masculinity that America supposedly hardwired into its males was that it caused a more or less constant state of fear that made genuine love next to impossible. Today's males were so constantly afraid of not measuring up that they had to spend all their time convincing others of their masculine validity in order to ease their own insecurity, making genuine love next to impossible. And although it seemed a little bit simplistic to see this fear as just a male problem, I mean, try watching a girl standing on a scale sometime. It turns out that Dr. Gustafson was very nearly right in his concept of the two. Maybe the real root of my problem was not fraudulence, but a basic inability to really love." It's a short story. It's a fictional tale. But it's more autobiographical in nature than perhaps David Foster Wallace would be cared to admit, even at the time that he wrote it. We're going to conclude our summer series by considering the book of Ruth and how she speaks something vital about the gospel of Jesus. Her story is an ancient story about fear and about love. It is about people who move from a state of emptiness and discover a fullness they did not bargain for. And if you think of life driven by fear as an empty life, and a life driven by love as a full life, then though this story is ancient, it could not speak more relevantly to our modern sensibility. We have 25 minutes to consider her whole story. We're going to read the first chapter, and we're going to try to summarize that life. From reading of God's Word, from Ruth chapter 1. "In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there, but Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died. She was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other, Ruth. They lived there about 10 years, and both Mahlon and Chilion died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. And then she arose with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. So she set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, 'Go, return, each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband.' And then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "No, we will return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way. I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." And then they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And she said, "See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts me from you." When Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, "Is this Naomi?" And she said to them, "Don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara. For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" And from the letter of 1 Peter, "Clothe yourselves, all of you, with humility toward one another, for God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, so that at the proper time he may exalt you, casting all your anxieties on him, because he cares for you." This is the word of the Lord. In chapter 1, we get the crisis and the seeds of the resolution. Israel is in a period of instability. If you know the book of Judges, you know she went through cyclical periods of both joy and great apostasy. That's why God had to raise up judges. And now, a series of bitter ironies. The promised land, the one supposed to be flowing with milk and honey, it's just scorched and shriveled to famine. Bethlehem, a city whose name literally means city of bread, is arid and dry and desiccated. It's a tragic irony. All that should have been wasn't, and all that they never dreamt of being is. It's just as tragically ironic to live in a city where every need you have is met and every technology available to you, but you can still die from a mosquito bite. That's their world. That's our world. And so this family of four, whose forebears had fought to get into the promised land, are now forced to get out to find food. They don't go north to Paddan Aram. They don't go south to Egypt. They go east into the region on the other side of the Dead Sea. They go to Moab, which is itself problematic for anybody reading this text, because it's the country of Moab who refuses to give Israel any aid when they're leaving Egypt on their way to the promised land. It's the king of Moab, who's threatened by Israel's reascendance, that actually calls forth the magic arts of a man named Balaam to curse Israel, a plan that goes horribly wrong because in the end, Balaam ends up blessing Israel rather than cursing them. And it's for those two affronts to Israel that the very law of Moses forbade the very presence of a Moabite in the assembly. So Moab may have had bread at the time. It was no Eden. It was no paradise if you're an Israelite. Family settles there, and what happens? Elimelech dies. There's no insurance policies in that day. There's no means of supplementing provision and protection when your husband dies. And then it gets worse. Her boys grow up, and they want to find wives. And they're in Moab. So they got to bring home Moabite wives. Talk about a guess who's coming to dinner moment. Naomi doesn't even get to ask the question, "So, is she Jewish?" Because everybody's from Moab. And just when you think it can't get any worse, Naomi's sons die. You want to talk about exposed. You want to talk about hopeless. You want to talk about an uncertain moment. That's your moment. Have you ever felt like saying, this is not the story I thought I would find myself in? That's Naomi's moment. A multi-layered crisis. She's lost everyone she's loved, and what she's gained is never something she ever dreamt of being associated with. What then? A distant message that maybe the Lord has visited his people again back in Judah, that maybe the rains have come and the land has been replenished and there's food there. And she hears that and she gets ready to move, and then there's this thing. She's in Moab with two Moabite daughters-in-law who are widows. And they might just want to stay there. It's their home. And so she releases them from their familial commitments. Their family, yes, but they'll want husbands too. They'll want everything that comes with that. And so going back to Israel is only going to limit their chances of finding a husband because, look, old prejudices die hard. And at first they refuse to leave. And Naomi presses the issue, saying how bitter she is at the Lord in her mind, because in her mind and in her words, he's gone out against her. And she just can't ask these two poor girls to suffer the same bitter fate. One daughter-in-law returns and goes back to her people and to her gods. But the other, Ruth, responds in a most unexpected way. She says, "Don't urge me to leave you to return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God." And hope begins again. It begins again for Naomi upon the deliberate act of one who has entrusted herself to the Lord and who has committed themselves to the welfare of another. Hope has begun. And as we said last week, when Rahab acknowledges her faith in the sovereignty of God, it was in some sense a rebuke to Israel's chronic faithlessness. I think we could say the same thing here about Ruth's unambiguous confession of faith in God and love for Naomi. It's a stinging rebuke because they know who they are and what they're there for. They're there to love the Lord their God with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love their neighbor as themselves. And here's Ruth, who was not catechized in the Torah from an early age, who's doing it better than they are. She gets it. And Naomi, who should, doesn't. And when Naomi finally relents and says, all right, let's go back to Bethlehem. There's this little awkward moment upon reaching the city limits. Everybody looks around and says, is that Naomi? She's been gone a long time. Is that her? And Naomi can only think to say, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara, which is a Hebrew word for bitterness. For the Almighty, she says, has dealt bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. See, Naomi does what we all instinctually do. We feel compelled to interpret our moment. Events happen, and since nature and our own minds abhor a vacuum, we look for theories to explain what's going on and why it's happening. She does that, we all do that. But in arriving at that conclusion, she demonstrates what ends up happening when we seek a quick answer. What happens is that she misinterprets her moment. She has lost much, but she hasn't lost everything. Including this woman that's standing beside her who has unsolicitedly and inexplicably committed herself to Naomi's good welfare by faith in God and love for her. You almost want Ruth to speak up and say, excuse me, am I chopped liver? We can commend Naomi for refusing to bottle up what she's thinking. We can understand her desire to make sense of her moment. We do that. But we all kind of flinch when her assessment fails to take in consideration the whole context, because she has to choose a measure of blindness to validate this little narrative she's composing about her condition. What does she have to be blind to? She has to be blind to the fact that there is more to her moment than she's taking consideration of, and she has to be blind to the fact that the story ain't over yet. And in that frame, in that chosen blindness, she lets bitterness become a kind of food for her. A feeble way of trying to get back at the world and at God because she's convinced she's been dealt a bad hand. You and I do that. We can conclude amid our sorrows that God has failed us, that he is not here, and we can become bitter toward him and toward the world, and that bitterness can become a kind of food for us. Rather than let hope remain, we can just refuse to let it in. And somehow we get juiced by that at some level, even if it's meager. Bitterness can become our food as it did for Naomi. But brothers and sisters, there's an alternative to bitterness that is not sad, but is no better than it. It's when we find just some sort of replacement for God as our food. An ultimate reality that we live for and strive for. The job, the spouse, the house, the promotion, fill in the blank, the plan, the dream. And in making any of that our food, we are anything but bitter. There is not a glum face in the house if that is your aspiration, but there is a cost. Naomi had in some sense jettisoned her trust in God and it erupted in bitterness. But listen to what David Foster Wallace said. When you don't so much jettison your trust in God, which we might call worship, but just make something other than God your ultimate trust. Listen to his words. There's actually no such thing as atheism. There's no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And the compelling reason for maybe choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. Worship your body and beauty and sexual allure and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally grieve you. Worship power, and you will end up feeling weak and afraid. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, and you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. But the insidious thing about these forms of worship is not that they're evil or sinful, it's that they're unconscious, they're default settings. Wallace is saying that if there is anything you make in this world that is your ultimate food, your ultimate worship, it will eat you alive, and you won't know until it's too late. Just like bitterness. Naomi lost pretty much everything. And in the fear of that loss, bitterness came upon her and was eating her alive from the inside. But the story wasn't over yet. How was it going to resolve? She owns a piece of land of her dead husband, but that land is as arid because it hasn't been worked in 10 years. And Naomi is too old to work the land, but Ruth isn't. And so she heads out in faith that maybe there'll be somebody out there that will look past the fact that she's a Moabite woman and let her glean in the field to get some grain so that they might eat. And the text says in chapter 2 that she just happened to find a field owned by a man named Boaz. And from the moment we meet Boaz, he is esteemed as one who lives by faith in the Lord. And not only does a Boaz allow her to glean, he sees to it to make sure that there's some left over, and that in a world where men would take advantage of women at the drop of a hat, he ensures her safety. Because see, look, by this time, what Ruth has done has made it to the ears of everyone in town. How she left everything she knew by grace, through faith in God, and for the love of her mother-in-law. And when Boaz hears of that, he affirms it in two ways. He prays, "May the Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." And then he lavishes her with more grain than she could ever bring home herself. And Ruth, the text says, marvels at his kindness. She goes home to Naomi, brings forth the haul, and then says, "There's this guy named Boaz. He let me glean in his field, and this is what he's given me." And when Naomi hears that, the iceberg of her bitterness thaws a little. And she says, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." You better perk your ears up at that word kindness, because if you were here last week, you heard it again. It's the same word that Rahab used to speak of the kindness that she sought from the spies in exchange for the kindness that she showed to them by concealing their presence. It's the Hebrew word hesed. And it's this word hesed, this kindness, that is a very character trait of the Lord, who means to give abundant, devoted care to his people. And the author of Ruth wants us to see that the character of God is at work in the movements of men and women, if only their hearts are his. And that kindness works so profoundly that Naomi's heart is changed. And now she wants to show similar kindness to Ruth. And so she hatches a plan, which, if you were to read in detail in chapter 3, will sound to you absolutely nuts. If you're a Moabite woman in Israel at that time looking for a husband, the likelihood of that happening is about as good as a South Carolinian finding a job in Boston in 1863. It's not going to happen. But in light of Boaz's kindness already, Naomi believes that Boaz, a middle-aged, single man with care and concern and respect for a woman of faith, that he might actually take Ruth as a wife. He is a kinsman, a member of their clan. And therefore, she attempts to play, if you will, matchmaker, but in a rather unorthodox fashion that I would commend to no one in this room. She tells Ruth to make herself presentable, to wash up, to get dressed, and then go down to the threshing floor after Boaz and all the men have finished and are asleep, lay down next to him, and uncover his feet. Ladies, don't try this at home. Because the primary message in that culture, by that custom, was to say, "I am offering myself to you in marriage." Commentators look at what Naomi encouraged Ruth to do, and you might say it's a mixed bag. Some of them think, yeah, it's noble in an intention, but have you ever heard of a more reckless and rash plan? Boaz could have taken advantage of her. He might have rejected her outright, which means that's a fail. Or Ruth might have accidentally awakened everybody in the room, which compromises her integrity and Boaz's integrity. That's a fail. But there are some commentators who see something even more profound than Naomi's idea. Because in what follows after Ruth's bold offer of herself in marriage, some see a beautiful act that's transformed into something even more beautiful. Boaz awakens in a fog and finds her at his side. And Ruth says, "Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer." Oh, there's so much in that one phrase alone. When she says, "Spread your wings," it's the same phrase that Boaz had used a chapter before when he affirmed how Ruth had taken refuge under the wings of the Lord. And so when she says that, she's saying to Boaz, "I wish to come under the wings of the Lord. By coming under your wings as a wife, I want you to answer your own prayer." And this is what Naomi wanted. He's a kinsman. He recognized this is a widow, and he wants to fulfill the obligation that was in Jewish law about being able to care for a widowed woman who had no one to take care of her. But Ruth at that moment goes off script. Naomi said, "He's a kinsman. Maybe he will give rest to you. Maybe he will marry you." But when Ruth says, "You're a redeemer," she's asking for more from Boaz than just to take her as a wife. She's asking that he would do something for Naomi, that he would buy the land of Naomi's dead husband and see to it that Ruth and he would bring forth children that would perpetuate the name of Naomi's dead husband, Elimelech. Naomi had sought good for Ruth, and now Ruth is turning it around to seek an even greater good for Naomi. And Boaz sees these extraordinary kindnesses, and he can't help but comply. And after seeing to one last hurdle in the process, he takes Ruth to himself, and they marry, and they conceive a child. And the author ends the narrative doing something quite out of step with any other biblical book. He puts a genealogy at the end. And we learn that the child that Ruth and Boaz had brought forth is none other than the grandfather of King David. The account closes with fullness replacing emptiness. Naomi's bitterness toward God is replaced with joy in God. Elimelech's line is rescued from obscurity to bring forth an heir. Israel's King David is waiting in the wings to bring order and to be a shepherd unto a people that were in need of a shepherd. And now here's Ruth confirming God's plan that he has an interest in making those that are not of his people part of his people, even Moabites, even Dallasites. How is fullness come to rescue emptiness? By the kindness of God behind the scenes and the kindness of God on the ground in the hearts of those who are his. Or to put it more simply, human kindness grounded in divine kindness. Human hesed grounded in divine hesed, which sounds so highfalutin and so ancient. What is this kindness? Listen one more time to David Foster Wallace's definition of kindness. It's when you've treated people with extraordinary decency and love and pure, uninterested concern just because they were valuable as human beings, the way we would treat a really good, precious friend or a tiny child of ours that we absolutely loved more than life itself. That's kindness. That's hesed. But Wallace says the hardest part of that kindness is, quote, "the ability to do that with ourselves." "I think part of the job we're here for is to learn how to do it," he said. Remember what he said through the words of the therapist that the 30-something had sought in the short story. We live either by fear or by love. And to the extent we live by fear, we cannot love. And now he is saying we even have difficulty believing that we can be loved. It was that sort of agony that ultimately consumed David Foster Wallace. And it is that sort of difficulty that may not consume us to the same degree that it did for him, but will plague us if it is not addressed in us. So what will rescue us? What is that one thing that we can worship and that will inspire not fear, but love? That one thing that we never have to fear losing and therefore are freed to love? That one thing that love, as Ruth loved, as Boaz loved, and as David Foster Wallace longed to learn to love, what is it? The ultimate human kindness grounded in the ultimate divine kindness. Or in other words, the kindness of God in the God-man, the Lord Jesus. You find what allows you to live without fear of measuring up when you come to trust the one who says by his death and resurrection, "You are mine and eternally loved despite your sin and despite your failures. Go sin no more. You are mine." The love of Christ in the gospel is a faithful love that we find whispered in the book of Ruth. Because Jesus, too, came to bring favor. He also came to bring kindness par excellence. He, too, came for a bride and sacrificed all he had for her, for his church, so that she had protection and provision. He came not to keep our name from being blotted out from history, but to keep it from being blotted out from the book of life. And so what do we do with Ruth? When she says, spread your wings, it's a double entendre. Wings can represent a garment, which means take me as your wife. Wings can represent refuge, which means the care of God. And she wants to be covered in that kindness, clothed in it. And in asking for such, she's humbling herself. And that's why Peter says to those of you who are in Jesus, clothe yourselves in humility toward one another. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God. How? By casting your anxieties upon Him. By turning your fears into prayers. By working the struggle back to what God has done and still promised to do for you in Christ. It means you acknowledge that there is more to any given moment than you can see and that the story isn't over yet. To clothe yourselves in humility toward one another means you don't have to wait till your storyline finds resolution before you show kindness to those who are likewise in a state of uncertainty. It's the application of humility that we see in Ruth and is made possible in Jesus. Brothers and sisters, there's an emptiness all around us and within us that will only be filled by a love that will not let us go. And so I say to you, because I think Ruth says to us in Jesus, humble yourself before Him so that at the proper time, which is now and later, humble yourself so that He might exalt you in love and for love.